Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Conspiranormal. You'll hear me say that again here in just a little bit, but we just wanted to come up and say that tickets are available for a Strange Realities Conference 2021 happening here in Nashville and online October 15th, 16th through 17th.
Hybrid, just like your alien children.
That's right. Hybrid, just like your alien children. Maybe Joshua Cutchin will talk about that at Strange Realities Conference. And tickets right now, I have listed on Eventbrite. We will also have that. We will have that link posted up to this episode, as we will have for every episode from now until October. But the tickets are $70 if you are coming to Nashville, and $30 if you are viewing it online. Also, we are about to have PD Newman on this episode, episode 361. I think that's right. And he's going to be there with us in Nashville, planning on it.
Yeah, so we got a great show coming up here with P.D. Newman about his new book, Angels in the Vermilion.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys, we're going to go to the interview, but stay tuned. In our outro, we are going to have another announcement about Strange Realities Conference.
This is Conspiranormal.
Welcome back to Conspiranormal. It's your host, Adam, and Serfiel is in cyberspace and right across from me. I don't know how exactly that works, but it is. That's what it is, so.
It's called bilocation.
Yes, it is. It's called bilocation. So, guys, we have with us one of our favorite guests. When did we have P.D. Newman on last? Was it 2019?
I think it was 19.
Okay. So, it's starting to all kind of just, like, meld together. So, I was trying to figure if it was 18 or 19. And we talked about your book, Alchemically Stoned. Welcome, P.D. Newman, back to Conspiranormal. For the second go-around, we're going to talk about your book, Angels in Vermilion. And this is called the Philosopher's Stone from D to DMT. So we're going to talk about more correlations between Freemasonry and the possible use of hallucinogens and entheogens. So let's dig into this. There's a lot here.
A lot to talk about.
So like I said before, this is kind of a continuation of Alchemically Stoned, and in that book you can talk about all these different plants that show up in the various like esoteric and like mystery school traditions and later show up in Freemasonic imagery as well. And one of those is the acacia plant. And in this book, you are primarily focused on the acacia plant. So this is kind of like a continuation of Alchemically Stoned, but kind of like expounding on it.
Well, the new book doesn't just focus on the acacia, but because of the evidence that we have to prove its use within a entheogenic context, it becomes the primary focus, especially in the first book. But in the new book, let me back up a little bit. In the first book, we were able to demonstrate that DMT was being used via a psychoactive species of acacia within Masonic ritual, but we were unable to arrive at a conclusion as to how that came to be. How did it get in Masonic ritual? Was this a case of Cagliostro appropriating a symbol that was already there because of his knowledge of it being psychoactive? Or was it put there intentionally because it's psychoactivity? You know, this was still a big open-ended question with the first book. And with the new book, what I've done and what I realized I had to do was to take a step back from Masonic lodges and sort of look at the problem within an alchemical context instead of a strictly Masonic context, because what we're seeing in Masonry is are alchemists using it in this way. So once I started going back and working my way through the European alchemical texts, that's when I realized that all of this stuff, this particular line of transmission, had to do with what Elizabethan alchemists, Dr. John Dee and Sir Edward Kelly, were doing with their angelic actions, is what they call them, which is how they created what's known as the Enochian system of magic. So to answer your question, why focus on Acacia? Mainly because that's where the evidence is. But once we get into the alchemical territory, we realize that the problem is much larger than that.
And through this Elizabethan alchemy influence is where this influence into Freemasonry really comes, where they kind of codify it, and Cagliostro as well. This is like a alchemical influence.
Mm-hmm. And so you don't see Acacia referenced by name in Dee and Kelly's work, but you see references to drugs in the diaries. Yeah. You see one point where the angels are telling them, you know, you can't go forward with this ritual, you don't have enough drugs to finish it. And he says, well, I might be out of those drugs, but I have these ointments, they should work, which I think is probably a reference to flying ointments, which is ointments that contained belladonna and mandrake, other hallucinogenic compounds. But so in addition to that, there's been several commentators and authors to discuss what Dee and Kelly were doing in terms of drugs and draw those connections. One good example is Gustav Meyrink, who wrote The Angel in the Window, Angel in the East Window. I can't remember the exact title. But he was a famous student of a group of German Rosicrucians, people styling themselves Rosicrucians. But he wrote about this red powder that Kelly was in possession of being a drug. And in his case, he claimed it was an incense that they were burning. But my argument is, it doesn't matter if it was a drug or wasn't a drug, because the important thing is Elias Ashmole, who was Dee's biographer, thought it was a drug. He had been investigating Dee's diaries. He had come into possession of Dee's papers in addition to being his biographer, and had been reading about these angelic actions, communications with these angels, and immediately tied it to he being the scientifically minded person that he was, immediately tied it to Edward Kelly's powder, because the as the story goes, Kelly was in possession of this red powder and a manuscript he couldn't read, this alchemical manuscript known as the Book of Dunstan, and he couldn't decipher it. And he thought that it had instructions on how to make more of this red powder. So he seeks out Dee, who already had a reputation of being an accomplished alchemist. He seeks out Dee to try and get him to decipher this for him. Well, Dee is already looking for a scryer who can help him accomplish his goal, which is to communicate with angels for the purpose of essentially spying on other governments and Kelly is immediately amazing at this. Completely dazzles Dee with his abilities to see and communicate with angels. And anybody who's familiar with DMT should already be thinking, well, you know, one of the most common effects of DMT intoxication, as Dr. Rick Strassman pointed out in his book, is encounters with what are described as transdimensional entities or right. angels or aliens or, you know, any number of weird kind of fairy descriptions. But so he's seeing angels. And Ashmole is intensely interested in this and wants to get his hands on some of this powder, because he's got the papers on how to do the rituals. Now he just needs the powder to finish it. So he brings this to the attention of Robert Boyle, another founder of the Royal Society, who was elected as a president of the Royal Society, even though he turned the position down several years after the formation. But he comes to Boyle with this claim of a red powder that allows you to talk to angels. And Boyle himself was already investigating the same thing via this alchemist named Wenzel Seyler, who had come in possession of this red powder himself. And it turns out through this letter that a man named St. George Ashe sent to Boyle, sent to the Royal Society, to Boyle, care of the Royal Society, telling him that this powder that Wenzel Seyler possessed came from none other than Edward Kelly. So Ashmole and Boyle are both in search of powders from different people who, it turns out, ultimately came from the same person. And Boyle wrote a paper about this. It was a published paper about, you know, how could there be a corporeal substance, a physical substance that somehow causes communication or visual perception, communication with or visual perception of an incorporeal entity. He says it doesn't make sense. Why would there be angels hovering about this substance? So he doesn't understand it, but he immediately understands that it must be a drug. Now, at this point, he issues this document that's now known as Boyle's wish list, a document that was put on display by the Royal Society in 2010. And it's a list of things he wants to acquire for the Royal Society to study. And every single one of them have to do with drugs, virtually every one of them. He talks about, he wants to acquire the fungus mentioned by a French author. We don't know which French author, but Chris Bennett speculates it's probably Rabelais, who talks about agaric mushrooms in what appears to be an entheogenic context. Boyle mentions that he wants to acquire the Egyptian electuaries, which again, Bennett speculates is probably hashish electuaries like Dawa Mesk and Majun, probably the oldest known edibles we have, cannabis edibles. And then he even says he wants drugs that cause pleasing dreams and epileptic fits and superhuman strength, all of these things that are clearly indicative of he's trying to find a drug that will get him to communicate with angels, that'll make this happen for him.
Yeah, much like Dee did, right? This is the idea, like communication with, like, the, as Dee called them, the Enochian angels.
The Enochian, that's right, based on the biblical Enoch.
Right.
Who allegedly, you know, walked with deity and then was taken up mm-hmm. with the angels or with God. But the Royal Society, because of their suspicion that what Kelly had was a drug, were very interested in psychedelics. And it was from this background that John Theophilus de Sagulier, the third Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge in London, came from when he took his position as Grand Master. He was research assistant to Sir Isaac Newton in the Royal Society. So part of this group of men investigating psychedelics. Another one was Robert Hooke, who was curator of experiments in the Royal Society. Around the same time, he puts together two separate lectures on the effects of hashish, talks about how it gives you, makes you exceedingly hungry and makes you fall asleep, and, you know, describing its effects. So they're intensely interested in psychedelics. And it's this guy, Desaguliers, who we now know through the research of Dr. David Harrison, that he's the one who put the acacia into the Masonic ritual. Now, I speculate that he was the one responsible for it in my first book, but I couldn't do any more than speculate without knowing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know at the time about Boyle's wish list, you know, didn't know that he had an active interest in psychedelics. So it was he who inserted the acacia symbol into Freemasonry. So when we go back to that initial question that we were faced with at the end of the first book, how did this come to be? Did Cagliostro appropriate a symbol and make it entheogenic? No, it appears that this entheogenic bent of the fraternity was there within a decade of its inception. Pretty fascinating to me. It completely rewrites the history of the fraternity as we know it.
Right. So just the idea that, you know, they were looking into this drugs and the Royal Society. I mean, this is something that you're probably not going to hear like mainstream history. I mean, the Royal Society is, I mean, it's pretty damn key to, you know, the Enlightenment in and of itself. I mean, you mentioned Isaac Newton, but they were, you know, they were kind of just like Newton was, they were kind of the last kind of like, you know, old school alchemists or magicians, but they were also the first scientists. So they were kind of like on that cutting edge between science and magic. But yeah, you're not going to hear any of this stuff that they would have been into looking at these drugs, even if it was like for even like scientific experiments.
Right. It's been basically whitewashed at this point, but you know, from a Masonic perspective, but from the Royal Society perspective, I mean, from that angle, they did put the document on display in 2010. They're proud of it, you know, so they,
mm-hmm. Right.
It seems to me that at this point they grasp the heritage. But as far as Masonry goes, you know, Freemasonry in its history has been wrapped up with accusations of being involved with things like the French Revolution and revolutionary ideas in general. Just surround Freemasonry. So I think the fraternity this day and age is really invested in, and it's a charge we're even given in Mississippi, where we're told, you know, to basically follow the laws of the land, mm-hmm. that you're not to be this kind of revolutionary figure, but they certainly were. And the use of entheogens like this, I'd hate to call it revolutionary at the time, because, you know, I don't know how, it's hard to really put that in perspective. In my new book, Jamie Paul Lamb, he wrote the foreword for it. And he talks about, you know, how at this time when this took place, there really was no war on drugs. And
right.
their concept of these experiences would have been very much discussed in terms of Enoch is a great example of visions of Ezekiel and John of Patmos. This would have been apocalyptic type stuff for these guys, not, hey, let's go trip this weekend. And right.
They wouldn't have seen it as hedonistic at all.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. And a good example is Melusino, who was just like Cagliostro, was using the acacia in an entheogenic context in his versions of Masonic rituals. The seventh and final degree, where he has the candidate actually taking the substance, he insists that it take place not in a lodge, but in a parish. It has to take place in a church, which is a clear indication of the spiritual nature for him how he perceived.
Yeah, it's like using it as a sacrament, basically.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Because I mean, there is that speculation that, you know, Rick Strassman, you mentioned him earlier. I mean, I know that he has talked about some of the, and you may have mentioned this in the last book, I don't really remember, but he has a whole book about the Old Testament prophets and the idea that they may have been taking some kind of DMT or some kind of something similar. This actually, funnily enough, shows up in the movie Noah, where, you know, Anthony Hopkins plays Methuselah and he gives Noah this paste that he like drinks, and you know, he goes on this drug trip, and that's how he gets his vision from God, which I thought was very interesting in a supposedly biblical movie, but that's kind of an unconventional biblical film. But I don't see that, you know, they would see it any different than any other kind of means to, you know, communicate with the divine, really.
They wouldn't have said this is a drug. It would have been mind blowing, I think. It would have been completely novel. And it's hard for me to put that into perspective. I just have such a difficult time being able to approach it in that way. I mean, the experience of DMT is one thing. It in itself is revelatory, but to try and understand how it would have been perceived by a layman being given this stuff in an initiatory context without any frame of reference for it other than Bible stories, it's hard to imagine how that would have been perceived.
Yeah. And you look at this in the book, there's one vision that you, it's towards the end of the book that you describe, and it's basically kind of like a psychedelic drug trip. I mean, it's a really kind of like a DMT kind of experience. So to kind of back up a little bit, the acacia plant, basically, you can derive DMT from that.
Some of them. So there are some 1,000 species of acacia, and roughly 100 of them are known to contain some form of DMT. It might be NN-DMT, it might be 5-MeO-DMT, it might be the bufotenine substance, which I'm still not completely clear on what that is. I know it's present in Anadin and Thera, Colubrina or Peregrina, which is what they make Yopo snuff from. And interestingly enough, that's what you may already know, but the first person to document Yopo use was Christopher Columbus when he sailed through South America. Huh. So his documentation, that document is known to have also been in possession of the Royal Society. So they would have been reading about Christopher Columbus talking about Yopo. And at the time, even though it comes from an Anadin and Thera tree, Anadin and Thera is virtually indistinguishable from acacia. It's got the exact same bipinnate compound leaf structure. I can't distinguish them. They look the same to me. And I think they would have looked the same to members of the Royal Society too.
Right. You also have this concept of the Philosopher's Stone, which is a huge concept in alchemy. I mean, obviously this has kind of been popularized by like the Harry Potter series or whatever, but you know, you speculate in, I believe in the previous book and in this book, that really what's going on in alchemy, all that stuff is just like code word for some kind of entheogen. Is that correct?
All of it. Not all of it. There is no one unified, unbroken chain of alchemy through European and previous. There is none. Even in just, if we just isolate European alchemy, there are as many alchemical schools as there are practitioners, because basically each of them were left to their own devices to try and determine how to make sense of the recipes in many of these manuscripts. And you might find two alchemists who arrive at completely different solutions that both satisfy the requirements in the document. So it's not as simple as saying this is what alchemy was, but it's certainly that there was an alchemical tradition that was very much interpreting alchemical language in this way. The use of the philosopher's stone, that kind of language, starts with a guy named Zosimos of Panopolis, who is a Gnostic Egyptian alchemist priest. He was in charge of statuaries, dying statues for temples and ritual purposes. And this is really significant in Egyptian religion because statues, similar to in Neoplatonism, statues served as what they called sunthamatar, symbola, tokens or symbols that, because of their likeness to these deities, they were able to capture these deities. So if you think about the deity itself as being like the sun and its overflow of energy being like those sun rays, then the statue, and Porphyry even describes it this way, the statue becomes like a mirror that can capture that essence. The more like that essence it is, the more it's able to capture it. And what determines likeness is certain cult images for these deities, colors, certain geometric shapes in certain cases, animals, certain stones, what you see called correspondences in occult traditions like the Golden Dawn, or what Jacob Burma called signatures. So Zosimos, he was very much concerned with being able to dye metals specific colors, making them fit receptacles for these divine energies. And this was a highly guarded secret because it made them receptacles for these divine energies. So the knowledge of how to dye metals is primarily what alchemy originally concerned. So that's where you get this misreading of those early manuscripts as transmuting metals. They're changing colors to maybe look like another metal, but they're not changing and becoming different metal. And that's the real difference. And the means by which this was affected and changed was this substance called the Philosopher's Stone. By the time you get to European alchemy, the Philosopher's Stone has become this mythical substance that through alchemy is produced, that then as a stone can transmute base metals into gold, and as an elixir can cause you to be immortal. These ideas, again, are appropriated from this metallurgy terminology. But by the time we get to Europe, especially after Paracelsus comes along and with his plant Spigeria, and previous to him, there was Raymond Lully, who had rediscovered alcohol distillation. So with alcohol and plant Spigeria, we now have the technology to extract essences from plants. Once they start playing around with plants, this is called the wet path of alchemy versus the dry path, work with metals and minerals. Once they start playing around with plants, they realize that you can make a stone from a plant. So in European alchemy, that was primarily concerned with, even though they still were concerned with transmuting base metals into gold, in most cases, they still thought that the source for the philosopher's stone, what they called the prima materia, the first matter, what you had to get to make the stone from or extract it out of, they thought that substance was still found in the plant kingdom. So they were messing with plants to find the stone to change metals. Now, of course, the transmutation of metals, once that was realized to be a farce, entered the realm of metaphor, so that we have, and that's really not even true either, because there's evidence at the early dates with Zosimos that these metaphors were still in place, that that base consciousness or base man can be transmuted into mm-hmm. something enlightened or illuminated. So it enters the realm of metaphor. So now you've got the idea that a stone can come from a plant that then can somehow enlighten you. Now we're really in drug territory, you know.
Right.
A shift
right.
in consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. Then it becomes real obvious, right? It's just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing here. It's a slow transition. And by the time we get to people like Cagliostro, very able alchemist, we have a tradition set in place where the acacia is being identified as the prima materia, the first matter of alchemy. From this prima materia, they're extracting a stone, that's DMT. With this stone, they're then able to transmute base metals into higher metals or initiate people. So we're seeing a very organic development, but by no means one tradition that's unbroken, continuous. And it's real tempting to look at it that way because, you start to think, well, the acacia was important in Egypt. How do we know that that wasn't in play? It may have been, but we don't have evidence that we can point our finger at and get anywhere with it, you know.
And the Philosopher's Stone, then in this particular tradition, you think is very likely to be this red powder that you keep finding everywhere.
So when, if you look in the best line of like the lineal transmission that's given, that this imagined lineal transmission comes from Fulcanelli, the imagined fictional alchemist Fulcanelli, his second book, Dwelling of the Philosophers, he gives a list of every alchemist who has claimed to have handled, used, or seen the Philosopher's Stone. And it begins with Kelly. Kelly is the first one who has it. And the reason it begins with Kelly is because Kelly is the one who claimed to have found it in the grave of this this bishop who actually was Dunstan of Canterbury, which is why the manuscript was labeled Book of Dunstan. But so it begins with Kelly. But what you realize real fast reading through it is that the characteristic factor of all of them, the unifying characteristic is this red, brown, orange color, the vermilion, crimson, the same language shows up, tawny, ruddy. And this is also significant because when Christopher Columbus is describing the Yopo, he describes it as a cinnamon colored powder. So again, we're back in the territory of this brown red powder. And as an aside, when the explorer A. Humboldt identified the tree from which the natives were making this cinnamon colored powder, he didn't identify it as Anadinanthera. He identified it as Acacia Niopo. So this tree that they're already interested and knew about was being actively identified as an acacia.
What's interesting is that, like, especially when alchemy kind of came back into popular consciousness, really post Jung, it seems like, and people usually focus on alchemy as metaphor for personal transformation, whether you view that more psychological or more spiritual. But what you're talking about is like both simultaneously, because there is that personal transformation, but in your exploration of alchemy, you're actually finding a physical philosopher's stone though, that right. then accomplishes right. that work.
Link.
Yeah. It's like a synthesis.
You're always seeing that with the stone, the alchemist is perfected. Somehow there's this, both are happening at the same time. And for Jung, this was happening by way of projection. They were achieving perfection, or at least a state of psychological unity through the achievement of this perfected state of matter. That's perfectly possible. I mean, that's set and setting. That's how ritual works.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not That's not in question. But I really feel like this is the unifying factor that bridges that gap between laboratory alchemy and internal alchemy. In Chinese alchemy, they have they talk about neidan and weidan, internal and external alchemy. And I find that also fascinating insofar as this substance is also endogenous. There are ways to produce it without a lab or without the drug outside. And then if you don't want to do it that way, you can also do it in the lab. It's the ultimate vas hermeticum. The inside is like the outside and the outside is like the inside. It's the best solution I've been able to find to the problems presented in the alchemical manuscripts.
Let's talk a little bit about, I want to hit this, the grand elixir. You mentioned this, Desaguliers. Is that how you pronounce that?
Desaguliers.
Wow. Okay. Desaguliers. The grand elixir. So you talk about a couple of things that we kind of have to understand. To understand the grand elixir in the book, you talk about the chaining of the golden dragon and the enjoyment of the silver lady. And what does all this mean? How does it relate to the main thesis of the book?
Well, the Grand Elixir comes from an expose that was published in a newspaper called The Post Boy. And it's been dismissed by Brent Morris, who's a fantastic researcher. But I don't agree with his readiness to dismiss it because there's too many anomalies that raise questions in other areas. This is a great example. So it says the very last question, and it's set up in terms of questions and answers because that's how Masonic catechisms are set up. You're asked a question, you give a specific answer. Mm-hmm. So the last question and answer consists of something like, what are the secrets of masonry or the finest secrets of masonry or something like that? But the answer is knowledge of the constitution of the grand elixir. And then it lists a series of other things. One of them is subduing nature, which is in masonry, that language shows up in subduing the passions. So it has more to do with vices, subduing vices. But yeah, then it talks about the chaining of the golden dragon and the enjoyment of the silver lady. This is clearly alchemical language, but what they're doing is Carl Jung calls it an enteodromia, a tendency of a thing to become its opposite. So when we look at alchemy, when we look at Indian alchemy, which has its correlations with yoga and is directly connected to yoga, there's this notion of the lunar god, a male moon god, Shiva, who exists in the brain. And then you have Kundalini Shakti, this solar goddess who exists at the base of the spine and the Muladhara chakra. And through the techniques of yoga, you coax her awake. Well, the techniques of yoga, what they do is they allow the seed of Shiva to build up, and it's imagined as being in the brain, in the Sahasrara chakra, the crown chakra, is imagined as being like a bowl that's through retention of orgasm and through pranayama and yogic practice, it fills with bindu, with this seed of Shiva. And once it fills, it begins to drip and overflow. And this dripping is what awakens Kundalini Shakti from her slumber and makes her ascend up the Sushumna, the path along the spine, to unite with her consort. This is the same Eros Gamos we see in alchemy with the marriage of the king and the queen, the red king and the white queen. And But in alchemy, it's usually the king who is associated with the sun, and it's the queen who is associated with the moon. Clear reflection of that in our modern thinking. We think about a very polarized masculine feminine relationship, but that wasn't so in ancient times. There's in ancient deities, most of the moon gods were male. You see, Soma was a male. You see, Sin or Nanar, he was a male. Several Native Americans have male moon gods, Native American tribes. But in our tradition, there's this clear male sun, female moon. This is what Jung is talking about, enantiodromia, a tendency of a thing to take on the characteristics of its opposite, which is it's paramount in alchemy. It's all over the place. The red lion becomes white with the tears of the eagle, and the white eagle becomes red with the blood of the lion. You could go on and on with the alchemical language. But so what we're seeing in this early Masonic expose is not only a reference to this grand elixir, the production of some kind of substance, but it's also directly tied in with this internal form of alchemy, this chaining of the golden dragon and enjoyment of the silver lady is just a reversal of the roles we just saw between Shiva and Shakti, but put in an alchemical / Masonic context.
So there's the stone and then the elixir. Is there any other place where you find this red powder? Kelly is he the earliest one in this manuscript that Kelly supposedly finds?
No, you find, so there's hints at it, what appear to be hints at it, like the famous Neoplatonic magician Apollonius of Tiana. He talks about a stone that appears to be the philosopher's stone. He says it's red and fills with the glints of the sun and talks about it having a spirit inside of it. And there are also other examples of similar stones at the same time. Zosimos was, I think, 3rd century. And in and around the same time, we have the Chaldean oracles, which talks about this I can't pronounce it. It's spelled Minirousi, I think. But it's a stone that is meant to be incinerated, to be burned. And it's directly associated with the vision of a daemon. And in her commentary on it, I'm going to butcher her name too. Dobler, I believe, is her last name. It's Tanishanu Dobler, I think is how you pronounce it. But she points out that she says, you know, this is really weird, strange language to burn a stone. Stones don't burn. She says, you know, so we probably should be looking at fumigation, being a fumigation going on. And she specifically notes that it would have to do with letting out vapors and smells. And that makes sense all of a sudden. And there's a similar stone that shows up in the Orphic lapidary that's called Nebrites. I'm butchering this, but it's Nebrites. And it's translated as jet stone. But again, meant to be incinerated, and its incineration is directly associated with epileptic fits. So there are more than just the philosopher's stone going on at this time. And it makes sense because this is right when alchemy was happening. And there's a famous alchemist named Cleopatra who's credited with the invention of the alembic. But that's just one example of alchemical technologies that would have been available at the time to allow them to arrive at a resinous stone alkaloid extract.
So you see this ancient tradition really continuing on in some form all the way into the Rosicrucians and into America and into the birth of practical occultism and theosophy.
It shows up. So when the Theosophical Society is a great example. When they form to be a continuation of Cagliostro by name, what Cagliostro was doing. And at the first meeting when they formed, they had intended to be a practical magic order. And George Felt, who was the first president or vice president of the Theosophical Society, he was to show people how this was possible. He had this way of demonstrating practical magic. Well, what he did was burned some kind of substance that caused everyone in the room to see therianthrope type figures that Henry Steele Alcott later compared to the figures in Francis Barrett's The Magus. Those figures are goetic demons. So he burned some substance that made them all hallucinate this kind of stuff. Now, if that was the only isolated incident, that'd be one thing. But in his published diaries, Alcott talks about how two of these theosophical masters, hidden masters, came and visited him, and that they lit up cigars and handed him a cigar, and that he lit his cigar, and that the room went away, and all of a sudden it was replaced by alien landscapes and filled with monsters that he again described as looking like the entities in Francis Barrett's Magus. And he says that they produced he found himself in a geometric cube, and that they produced flowers raining from the sky, and that it's and then rain showers, and that he noticed that their cigars weren't wet, but his was.
Smoking in wet blunts, man. Be careful.
Yeah. Why is his cigar wet? You know, he thinks it's because it's gotten rained on, but in an intoxicated state, in that state, you wouldn't really have that kind of continuous thought pattern. If it, I don't know what the substance was, but it's clear they slipped him a Mickey of some sort. They drugged him. And I suspect it's the same substance Felt was burning as an incense to cause visions for everyone. And yeah, we get on into the 1920s with what's called the Fulcanelli affair. Fulcanelli didn't actually exist. He was fabricated by a guy named Jean Julian Champagne using an unpublished manuscript by René Schwaller de Lubics, who was he wrote the famous giant Egyptian Temple of Man studies. He had done this study on alchemical symbolism in cathedrals. He gave it to Champagne to edit for publication. Champagne says, you can't publish this. This reveals way too many secrets. Well, he then proceeds to embellish it extensively and publish it himself as Fulcanelli. And this caused a rivet between them for a while. But the clincher is that Champagne was in a secret society by a pharmacist named Alexander Ruhier, who an entire 4 to 6 years before the publication of the Fulcanelli manuscript had been published, not only publishing on the effects of DMT and LSA and coca, but he had been growing peyote and making his own peyote tinctures, which he was sending out by mail order. So completely infatuated with psychedelics, but for him, in his papers, he talks about them as being, he calls it a paleo divinatory pharmacy, saying that these were tools to cause clairvoyance and make one, psychic, give you psychic abilities. So the circles that Champagne was running in, they were members of this secret society called the Grand Lunaire. And we don't know much about the secret society, but we know it involving champagne and Ruhiere, it mostly likely involved the use of peyote and probably DMT in a ceremonial ritual context. So yeah, this, it didn't just go away. It didn't just die out. There's use of DMT. I mean, all through the history of Western esotericism, everyone, it's popular to imagine that it's limited to ayahuasca, that there was no other use of it outside of ayahuasca, yopo, the more obvious DMT products or brews or whatnot. But no, that's not true.
Do you think at any point that it was there any point that it was lost? Or is there like a break? I mean, do you think that someone somewhere was continuing this tradition?
Yeah. And to add to that,
modern times.
Yeah. To add to that also too, like what I'm curious about is whether or not, they're borrowing from like way older traditions and like ancient, cause like if quote unquote non-modern peoples, use entheogens regularly in their religious ceremonies, then obviously at some point in the European prehistory, they were using those as well. So it's like, are they somehow drawing from those older traditions, or like, or is there a rediscovery?
There are acacia beers referenced in Egypt. There's a story called A Tale of Two Brothers. It's also called Anpu and Bata. That's the names of the two brothers. But it discusses how it's basically a version of Osiris and Apophis, of Osiris and Typhon and their battle. But at one point, the heart of one of the brothers gets placed in an acacia tree, and then it's harvested, and they make a beer out of it and drink it. So there's evidence of that kind, what looks like evidence of that kind of thing going on, but in as far as breaks in my book, in the new book, I pretty much am able to show a continuous line of transmission from Ashmole on up to Folconelli, to the Folconelli affair. Of course, we can't prove what Dee and Kelly were doing. They never mention acacia. Kelly, having found the powder in a grave, if that's really where he found it, wouldn't have known that it was acacia. He wouldn't have known where it came from. So we can't prove that that's what was going on with them, but we're 99.9% certain that Ashmole identified that substance as the acacia neopo he encountered in Christopher Columbus's records whenever they were working out cartography. The Royal Society was at one point making maps. What's the word I'm looking for? Not valid maps, but updated, realistic maps. So
right.
Columbus's records were, that's why they were in possession of him. So I definitely think that that's what Ashmole interpreted that red substance to be the same cinnamon colored powder that Columbus saw.
So that kind of was, as you're saying that, I'm kind of wondering, was this something that in Dee and Kelly's time could have been brought over from the New World?
It could have been, whenever all of this stuff started and they started their visions, his first mirror, and Jamie Paul Lim and I were just talking about this. He's going on vacation to down through Mexico. The mirror that he got was an Aztec black mirror, the same mirrors that they were taking mushrooms and staring into. So Dee's mirror was from the Americas.
That's very interesting. Do you think, if this got into like theosophy and some of the other occult movements prior to that, do you think that this became widely known in esoteric Freemasonry around the the old turn of the century or late 19th century?
I mean, Masonry as a phenomenon is widely known, but it's hard to say widely known Masonic stuff because by nature it's secretive.
Yeah, yeah.
So we, you know, it might have been widely known among those members.
That's what I mean. Do you speculate that it was widely known at a certain time?
I don't
time
know. No, I don't. I don't speculate that. Because I don't know. It could very well have been something that was reserved for specific members, or it could have been something that was.
In contrast to just having like a few alchemists here and there who were keepers of the secret, do you think finally when the Acacia was entered into Freemasonry, do you think that it was like propagated and there was just a network of people?
If it had have been, I don't think Cagliostro would have thought his work was so important or so different. I think, he was trying to turn out as many people as he could. He went to different lodges and told them, burn your minutes, you know, get rid of all your rituals, start doing my stuff. This is the right way. And in his ritual, he even says, you know, the sprig of acacia that was given to you in ordinary masonry, he says the word ordinary masonry, you know, he says that this stuff that you're drinking is nothing other than that sprig of acacia. So it's like he sees himself as cluing them into something that wasn't clear. So no, I don't think it was widespread. I think that if it was being done in a lodge prior to Melusino and Cagliostro's use, it would have been something hush-hush or not done at all and then kind of hipped to later, like, hey, you know, FYI. But we don't know, so I'm reluctant to speculate too far. Ashmole, we've talked about Ashmole. He appointed as rector of a parish in, I think, in Litchfield, a famous theosopher who was a follower of Johann Gichtel, who himself was a follower of Jacob Burma. John Pordage was appointed by Ashmole himself as rector of this parish. Well, shortly thereafter, Pordage and his wife start experiencing visions. They're experiencing manic visions to the point that they are seeing demons coming out of the bricks in their chimneys. And they're so panicked by this that they've both gotten hammers and they're outside chipping away at their house, beating their chimney. You know, I can't imagine how their neighbors would have perceived this if they had neighbors, but we're talking about two people that see demons in their bricks and are just beating the shit out of their house. So the way the theosophers after this episode talk about it is that, you know, he was experiencing the negative. You have to go through the demon side of existence before you get to the angelic visions. I think that's nonsense. That's just an attempt to explain something that didn't make sense to them. Reading the episode, it reads like nothing so much as a drug trip. And the fact that Ashmole appointed them, you know, I don't know if Ashmole was drugging them with the stuff, testing it to see what would happen. When I was first investigating, I thought, are they poisoned with ergot? Is this an example of ergot poisoning? And I did find out that in the same year in Saxony, Germany, there was an outbreak of ergot. And we know that the theosophers in Germany and England were in communication. You know, could that have happened that way? But if it was that, we would have most likely seen, you know, one of their kids probably would have died, or loss of digit, gangrene, some of the other symptoms that go along with ergot poisoning. So I'm thinking it can't be ergot poisoning. And so when I start really looking into Pordage more deeply, I find out that he is completely preoccupied with something he calls the red tincture of paradise. Mm-hmm. And all theosophers after him interpret this as a vision of Sophia, that the tincture is, Sophia comes into your life and tinctures your life. She colors it and changes it. I don't think that's the case. And we know that's not the case because Cagliostro, who, like we said, was giving his candidates DMT, he had a extended retreat that he did for his more advanced adepti, where he would give them higher and higher doses of this stone. And after 3 days, it says that you'll have to change the bed linens because they will have shit the bed. They will have puked on themselves. He's telling you that they will have purged. La Purga is actually one of the names for ayahuasca, the purge.
Right.
So after this purge experience, then they start experiencing their hair falling out, their nails fall out, their skin turns black, their teeth fall out. This is consistent with what's known as shamanic dismemberment. What happens with tryptamine experience and shamanic initiation scenarios where you experience your body coming apart and then either being put back together or being reborn as something new.
Yes.
This is very common language. And that's what we're seeing with Cagliostro. Well, the Ephrata community were followers of John Pordage, who
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Was connected with Jane Lead of the Philadelphian Society. And it was these German post-Gichtel theosophers had traveled through, you know, met the Lead, Jane Lead and their group, and went on to America and started what is now considered the first Rosicrucian society. But they weren't really Rosicrucian. They were theosophers. But it was eventually called the Ephrata community. And this was in Pennsylvania. And eventually this guy shows up who is a practicing alchemist. His last name is Martin. And he sets up an alchemy lab, and he's a follower of Michael Sendivogius, which is important because Sendivogius was known to have been in contact with Kelly. He sought them out and actually rented a house next to him so he could learn secrets from Kelly. So this guy who was obsessed with Sendivogius sets up this alchemical laboratory, and he has in his possession the document that Cagliostro had, this retreat document. And somehow it ends up in the hands of this man named Regnier. Regnier isn't a member of the Ephrata. He wants to be. He's been hanging out with them. He thinks they're cool. Somehow he's found out about this ritual. So he's like, well, I want to do it. Every one of them tell him, no, you can't do that. You're not ready to do that. So he says, screw y'all, I'm going to do it anyway. So he goes out in the woods, he builds him a little hut, and he starts doing the ritual and starts upping the dose every day. He ends up absolutely losing his mind. They have to chain this man up in a basement, and they whip him every day to try and get his senses back. Completely loses his mind. And in his own account, he says that, you know, when he finally got his senses back, he could be okay and know where he was. But if anything ever got crazy around him, he would slip back into that state, almost like have a flashback. And I think this is a clear indication of what we would now call psychedelic-induced PTSD. But, yeah, absolutely lost his shit. And if there was any question about the entheogenic nature of these rituals and this substance, this red tincture, this kind of stuff should lay it to rest. You don't have people losing their minds and having to be chained up for weeks at a time from meditating in the countryside.
It makes total sense. And that was kind of where I wanted to ask you was in some of this, like, even if it's not in the book or just things that you, when you were looking at all this, what were some of the experiences that these people had? Like, what was, you know, what were some, like, you just kind of described what was going on physically with that guy, but is there any, like, writings about what he might have seen, or just, like, are there any other writings about what these people were experiencing when they were doing this?
I'll read you a section from Pordage's experience.
Yeah, and a lot of it is really couched in, like, this real poetic language, too. this kind of, I guess, what is it, what, 17th and 18th century kind of poetic language.
So here we go. This is poor Dodge, his journal. He says, in August 1649, there appeared in my bedchamber about the middle of the night a spirit in the shape of Everard, with wearing his apparel, band, cuffs, hat, etc., who after the sudden drawing of the bed curtains seemed to walk once through the chamber very easily and so disappeared. That very night there was another appearance of one in the form of a giant with a great sword in his hand, without a scabbard, which he seemed to flourish against me, having the figurative similitude of a great tree lying by him. After this had continued the space of a half an hour, it vanished, and there succeeded a third appearance, which was very terrible, being in the shape of a great dragon, which seemed to take up most of the part of a large room, appearing with great teeth and open jaws, which he oft ejected fire against me, which came with such a magical influence that it almost took the breath right out of my body, making me fall to the ground. Now, you must know that these three were dreadful apparitions and very terrible to the sensitive nature, and might have caused a great distemper to it had I not been supported in an extraordinary way by the ministrations of the holy angels. So he's seeing angels, demons, you know, he is all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, amazing stuff.
And the negative experiences also, they have that alchemical parallel in the Negrito, in the disillusion before the coagulation. So all these
great example, great analogy to point out that the consistency in the models.
Yeah. And so like there's a lot of things in alchemy that you can see as having to do with the psychedelic experience itself, and psychedelic experiences have stages, and they definitely transform consciousness and the spirit, whatever you want to call it. But so yeah, there's just so many multiple levels of correlation.
Yeah, great point.
I really want to get into some nitty-gritty stuff as far as I guess some of the most spectacular elements are these ideas of like contacting other intelligences. And, you know, a lot of people are really concerned about this and think it's the reason why people shouldn't do this. And then you have other people who have the, you know, exact opposite disposition. But what are your personal thoughts on whether they're actually are intelligences that we are contacting, or are these just some kind of psychological mechanism or some kind of combination of the two, I guess?
But as far as other intelligences, you know, when you're in the moment experiencing it, there's no question. The experience is so reified that it takes a large amount of reality testing to get out of it when you've entered that stage, that would constitute what James David Lewis Williams called the third stage of trance, when you're completely immersed in the experience and most of the time don't remember you've taken a drug. In those moments, there's no more questioning the reality of it than we're questioning the reality of us talking to one another here. I mean, it's happening. And McKenna makes that point that the terrifying reality of it, that if you were just watching it displayed on the wall, a display, even if you knew it was a drug, it doesn't come with that terrifying reality of it, that the absolute sense of panic that comes along with the fact that you're not looking at something, but something appears to be looking at you. And it's a wholly different kind of a dynamic. But whether or not they're real, I don't think we have enough information to say, and I would just be speculating. But I did recently write a paper on the correlation between James David Lewis Williams' three stages of trance model and the three stages of reality in the cosmos of Neoplatonism. Now, that being said, without going into too much detail, the first stage of his trance model is constituted by geometric patterns, what are called form constants. The first stage in the cosmos in this Neoplatonic model is the noetic realm, which is populated with what's called the forms, the Platonic forms, which again have been repeatedly compared to geometry, namely to Plato's solids, being the archetypes that inform our experience here. So I do suspect that we might be experiencing an aspect of reality that is real and maybe not always perceptible, but as far as the entities, you know, you really backed me in the corner trying to get me to answer that, because I can just speculate. We don't have enough information to answer it.
Yeah, it is ultimately a mystery.
Well, I mean, as far as like that goes, I mean, for me, I mean, I definitely believe we're contacting something, but that's just my own personal opinion. I don't have any like kind of, you know, I guess objective reasoning behind it, but a lot of anecdotal evidence, but
it's just something that we can't know. So it's one of those things, we're right back in the realm of, we have to accept it on faith. Mm-hmm. So the only thing we can really do is experiment and repeat the experiment.
Well, if psychedelics had anything to do with the development of mankind as we know it now, you know, like going back to the stoned ape theory and things like that, then if these psychedelics put us in touch with something else, then these other beings might have had a large place in our development as well, like as the angels are in different traditions and other beings are, the star people or whatever you want to call them. So,
well, this whole Graham Hancock's idea that people were actually guided to by the plants themselves to make, you know, ayahuasca. I don't know if that's necessarily his idea, like originally, but I've heard this type of thing.
That's their own claim. A lot of those groups' own claim that I believe the plants themselves announced their use to the natives. And Jeremy Narby, he investigates that in his book, The Cosmic Serpent. But yeah, they claim that the plants talk to them themselves, them to them. And that kind of stuff is far outside of the realm of psychology. You're entering magical territory that just can't be explained. And mm-hmm. I myself believe, you know, I'm a believer. I believe in an absolute reality. It's something that I can't prove, but I have deep suspicions, and all of the evidence points towards the existence of something in my own personal experience and through the testimony of countless others. You know, the notion of messengers is undeniable. You can't just explain it away, but to be able to point my finger at it and say what it is, isn't, I just feel like I'm depriving myself of the mystery of it, which I think where the real magic is, being able to sort of walk that tightrope and say, I can't know this, and that's okay, because that's what's fun about it. You know, the beauty of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, and psychedelics have really, for people who aren't in an organized religious system or aren't traditionally spiritual, in our era, psychedelics have really gave so many of those people like a certainty of a spiritual reality who probably wouldn't have otherwise, or who left traditional spiritual paths. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that they're efficient because they really work on hard cases. And I would call myself a hard case. You know, before I had successful psychedelic experiences, nothing worked for me. You know, I had been doing psychedelics since I was a kid, but it wasn't until I got a little bit older and trying, you know, had an intention of achieving something spiritual, that I started having those kinds of experiences. But it wasn't coming from the meditation. It wasn't coming from the yoga. It wasn't coming from any of that stuff. And but after psychedelics, it was almost like, I hate to just say it, it gave me a breakthrough where it made those experiences easier, but it's almost like it gave me a frame of reference so that I could recognize when I was having a transcendent experience. Whereas before, I think it goes right past you. I think many people, normal people who don't try to say normal, but people who don't do psychedelics, I think have psychedelic experiences more than they're aware of. They just don't have a frame of reference where they can say, you know, where you can point your finger and say, I was in the deep end, and this is kind of like that. And it did that for me, so that when I went back and started working with things like pranayama, I noticed when I was getting results, whereas before I might have interpreted that as anxiety or something like that.
It's all very interesting stuff. My final question would be, and I think that, you know, the overall Freemasonic community has seemed to have embraced these ideas. I think that it would seem kind of controversial, I guess, to the older guard, but it seems like they have really accepted these ideas and your research. How has that journey kind of been for you?
Well, at first, when I first went down this path, I questioned whether I would even publish, because in the beginning, I was certain I would be expelled or something. I did, you know, something terrible was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But and I did get some pretty nasty responses, emails and messages from people. But I think most of that was fueled by a suspicion they didn't really know what I was saying. And I think it was a suspicion that I was encouraging this or saying this is how it should be done, when really all I'm doing is saying this is what was taking place at a certain time. And I think that after that kind of got into the heads of some of the older guard, they softened up a little bit. I haven't gotten a nasty message or anything in a while. So, a lot of that, I think, too, has to do with, it's just in the consciousness right now. I never thought something like this would happen with psychedelics being decriminalized. I've always looked at them as being sacred, and I kind of saw their illegality as almost, the taboo is protecting that sanctity. I just sort of had accepted that that's why they're illegal, that they cannot possibly be legal. But here they are being decriminalized, and it raises even more questions. I absolutely think they should be legal, but I wonder where it's going as far as our just global consciousness. Where are we as a nation, as a race, you know, or where will we be going once people start eating these substances on a large mass scale? I mean, like, yeah. I said, I'm all for them being legal, but I know how powerful they are firsthand.
Well, this kind of brings up the question of, like, this was a secret for so long in these circles, and now the secret is out, the cat is out of the bag. I mean, that's an interesting thing, because I've always, what you're saying, because I've always, you know, when you talk to people that are really into these things, they always look at it as very positive. And it kind of sounds like you've got a kind of like a mixed bag, that there could be some negative aspects to this too, So maybe it was a good thing that, like, this was something that very few people did, that they could really understand it. And, I mean, I've heard some things, like, you know, that young people shouldn't be doing it, that it should be something that's for older people, which is interesting. So, you know, could this be a bad thing if, like, you know, too many people are doing these drugs?
I mean, I don't think it could be bad in a natural sense, but I think it could be a societal sense. In the long run, I think it could only be good for society. In my case, it promoted positive values and positive morals, but that's me.
Right.
And, Alan Pinker, he's recently done some research on, you know, how psychedelics can land you in the opposite camp. Stanislav Grof, he talks about psychedelics being, the phrase he uses, non-specific amplifiers, I think is the phrase. Meaning that, sure, if you're in a set and setting and have been prepared for a peaceful, loving type experience, that might be what comes about. But it's not specifically going to amplify. For someone else, it might amplify a completely different part of their psyche. A good example of this is the tribe that uses ayahuasca in Brazil before they go to battle, before they go to war. I can't possibly imagine fighting on ayahuasca or any crypto psychedelic. Yeah. That is a nightmare to me. But for them, and I'm not saying that it's wrong, we have to keep it within their cultural context. But for them, it absolutely says something about war and fighting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not just like we can say that psychedelics are going to make everything peaceful and lovey. And I mean, I think if that was the case, we wouldn't have ended up with people like Bobby Beausoleil and mm-hmm. Charles Manson. You know, psychedelics can go any direction. I think that's one of the messages that Jim Morrison had. You know, he was surrounded by the peace and love folks. And, you know, of course, he wasn't up screaming bloody murder, but he was certainly pointing out the darker, more chthonic sort of Lovecraftian aspects of these experiences, old gods, you know, that kind of Lovecraftian stuff did not make sense to me until I had a good, you know, 10 grams of mushroom in me. And then all of a sudden that kind of stuff becomes very, not only plausible, but obvious, you know?
Right. Interesting.
I did want to make a little note here that I remember, it might have been a couple years ago. Let me see. I did find the blog. Actually, no, this is from 2018. That skeptic guy, Jason Colavito, got a hold of your book and, like, did this hit piece on you. And I just thought it was so ironic because, like, I mean, he's, like, arguing that you shouldn't be speculative with speculative Freemasonry. I mean, I did not get it at all. I thought it was funny. I remember, I think you posted on Facebook or something when that happened, but, did you have a back and forth with him at all?
Yeah. He admitted he didn't read my book, which I thought, how are you going to write a review? He didn't actually read the thing, but yeah, and again, I would argue I'm not being speculative. I am careful to not speculate. You know, if I'm pointing my finger at specific cases of drug use, drug discussion, drug investigation.
Yeah.
I'm very careful not to speculate. But yeah, I don't, and to be honest, I have no idea who he is. So I'm not.
He's just a naysayer. Just. You know,
yeah, everyone in the points, field, everyone in every aspect of the paranormal gets it, I think.
Yeah, they do. It's just,
I just really did not understand his bone to pick in that situation.
Is he a Mason?
I really doubt it.
No, I don't know. I don't think he is. But he goes after Scott Walter a lot because Scott Walter is a Mason, so maybe that's the association.
I thought it was the preoccupation. The preoccupation with the Templar treasure, so he just felt like I was stepping on his toes.
Yeah, probably. It's probably something like that.
It's probably that, you know, the suspicion that the treasure was never anything like treasure and had something more to do like this, which I never make that kind of claim, but
PD, this has been extremely fascinating. We've enjoyed having you on again. And we haven't even scratched the surface. I mean, this is a really short book, but like we've barely scratched the surface of what's in it. So, can you tell everybody where they can find this book? And also where, you know, they can find like what your other writings and like in your web presence.
Yeah. I'm in between web pages right now. We're about to make a new website, but the book, my first book, can be gotten through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble. It's also available through the publisher, which is a Laudable Pursuit Press. The new book, Angels in Vermilion, will also be available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the publisher as well through their website, which is Tria Prima. And yeah, just I do have an Alchemically Stoned presence on Facebook, kind of keep up with public speaking and newly published articles and things like that. So yeah, that's probably the best place to keep up with me.
Excellent. And we have a special announcement. P.D. Newman will be joining us
for
the 2021 Strange Realities Conference. And so hopefully you'll get
looking forward to it.
Yeah.
October 15th, 16th, and 17th. I think, PD, I think you will be actually joining us in Nashville. So we're looking forward to hosting you here.
So I'll be there.
Come get alchemically stoned in Nashville.
Yeah, maybe literally. All right, guys. We're going to close out this section, but guys, stay tuned. We're going to have a special announcement about the Strange Realities Conference yet again. So we'll be right back. All right, guys, welcome back to Conspiranormal. That was an excellent interview with P.D. Newman with about his book, Angels in the Vermilion, about DMT and the Philosopher's Stone and all kinds of interesting material. A lot of that stuff, man, I'll be honest with you, just kind of goes over my head. So you are way more equipped on the understanding a lot of that than I am. So... but it was an interesting interview, nonetheless.
Yeah, I think that it's a really good synthesis, like I mentioned when we were talking with him, a good synthesis of understanding alchemy as based on personal transformation and a operative physical thing going on that actually then enables that personal transformation. So it's a interesting way of looking at it. And yeah, I mean, he's really like at the forefront of solving some of the biggest historical mysteries about mm-hmm. psychedelics and the role of psychedelics in the Western esoteric tradition.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. And I really think that, he's really onto something, in this book and also in his previous book, Alchemically Stoned. It seems to be that, yeah, these people had this kind of like guarded secret of this, of using these drugs in the past. And I really liked what he said about, it being a form of a sacrament
mm-hmm.
as well. So I'm pretty, pretty impressed by that. So, we have a special announcement on top of the special announcement that we made earlier in the show.
we want to talk about Strange Realities Conference, and we're going to beat that like a dead horse all the way until October, so get used to hearing about it, because we really want you guys to either come to Nashville or be in sitting in the comfort of your home and watching the Strange Realities Conference that is going to be broadcast from SIR Nashville, which is where we did it back in 2019.
And you'll understand why we're so excited when we reveal the people who will be speaking there, which is about to take place right now.
Yes. So we are going to talk about the lineup that we have for the Strange Realities 2021 conference. There's going to be some people that have been there since the beginning, and some new people as well. Now, some of these people are going to be on site, and some of them are going to be just broadcasting from their homes. We don't know at the moment who is all going to be there, but we do know some for sure. So I will talk about who may possibly be there and on site for people to meet, and also who may not be. So, starting out, Tim Banal is going to be joining us.
As always.
The great Tim Banal. You know, what does he say? There's no comparison. You know, we're going to have him there. He's talked about flat earth material in the last two conferences. I believe he's going to talk about something else this year. And he's kind of keeping me in suspense on what that's going to be. He is going to be, even though he's going to be coming from Boston, we're going to be bringing him in. He's ready to come down to Nashville and have a good time with us. So Tim and I will be there.
There will be no rules and no comparison.
No rules and no comparison, yes. Great Banal of America. Nathan Isaac from the Penny Royal podcast will also be joining us. I'm sure he'll be dropping some knowledge on us.
In Nashville, fucking Tennessee.
Nashville, fucking Tennessee. Yes, that's it. Brent Rains will be rejoining us. Hopefully Brent will be joining us in person, as he's not too far from the Nashville area. Brent, of course, is a classic UFO researcher, and really does his homework on it. Dr. Future will be joining us. I'm hoping he will be able to come out. Pretty sure he will. Most of everybody's going to be probably vaccinated. So Dr. Future, who's like, you know, my mentor and pretty much the reason why I do this show. P.D. Newman, who we just heard in this episode, he will also be coming out. Looks like he will be coming to Nashville. I think that is pretty much a surety. Ren Collier, who is back with us. Ren will probably be helping us out with some technical things as well. Ren is going to try to come to Nashville, I believe. We're talking about it.
Yeah, a lot of this is still up in the air right now.
A lot of it's still up in the air. Steve Stockton, one of my favorite storytellers. He, like I've always said, could read the phone book, and I would be absolutely engrossed. Of course, he's in Portland, Oregon. Don't know if he will be coming out, but definitely he will be doing his own like online presentation. Aaron Gullius will also be coming back from last year's conference as well. You're the host of the Saucer Life podcast, author, and I don't know if he's going to be there in person or not, but that could be a possibility. Amy Petula will be joining us. She's the head of the Chattanooga Ghost Tours, and she wrote the book about the Corpsewood Manor murders that we did back in January. She will also be joining us, not sure if in person or not. Jose Herrera, who we had on just, I think the beginning of this year, or was it the end of last year? He will possibly be joining us in person.
Yeah, hopefully. I think he's in North Carolina.
Yes, yes. Chris Ernst will possibly be joining us in person as well. We may be possibly showing The Hill and the Hole one of those nights and maybe have Chris talk about it. We will see exactly what we're going to do on that. Recluse, also known as Steven Snyder, he's going to come down from West Virginia. So you guys, if you're coming, you will get to meet the mysterious recluse. And
maybe you shouldn't tell them that, Adam. We don't want any secret agents showing
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I know. You'll get to meet a giant spider. Kiki Dombrowski. She will be coming back up to the Nashville area from Georgia. She will be there. David Metcalf. We're trying to convince him to come. Hopefully he does. Timothy Renner. He's going to be coming back. Hopefully that he and will be coming driving down here with Soraya Askath from Where Did the Road Go? Our good friend Soraya. And he is going to be, he says he's going to be there and really
a rare in-person appearance.
Yeah. I'm going to try to get Soraya to do, see if he can, wants to do like radio, like interviews, because obviously we're not going to do that Conspiranormal because we're, you know, we're doing the conference. So, maybe Soraya could, can interview people there as well. Michael Hughes will be part of the conference. Don't know if he will be in person, but he will, definitely be, given a presentation online for sure. Joshua Cutchin will also be there. Looking forward to that. And we've got added Dr. Stephen Finley, who is going to be, we don't know what his presentation is going to be or whether he's going to be in Nashville, but definitely whatever it is going to be interesting. He is a professor of religion. We did a show with him last summer about the Nation of Islam and the wheel UFO that Louis Farrakhan encountered. And Heather Mosier will be also joining us. She will be, she is probably joining us here in Nashville, actually. Coming down from Ohio. She is the main researcher for the Small Town Monsters, Seth Breedlove's films as well. And last but definitely not least, the Grandmaster himself, Alan fucking Greenfield, will be there as well. I'm pretty sure that I have talked to Alan, and he really wants to come to Nashville. Yes. And we don't know. There may be some rituals involved. We don't know exactly what. Yes. All right. That is the lineup, guys. We hope that you guys are interested in at least one or two, if not all, of the people that we have going to be at Strange Realities Conference 2021. Again, that is October 15th through the 17th here in Nashville, Tennessee, and also streaming online for those of you that want to stay home. And those prices are $70 for in-person in Nashville and $30 in for online. Now, the way that it is listed as an online conference on Eventbrite. But just know that if you are paying the $70, that is for in-person. But you will also receive a link to stream the conference to whatever we're going to be streaming it to.
And we'll probably have the streams available after post-conference as well, so that you can catch up on anything you missed out. And that will probably be on there for a while, like we did this year with the Strange Realities 2020.
Yep. And for those of you that came to were a part of Strange Realities 2020, first of all, thank you. That is still up there if you guys want to go back and revisit that. So,
yeah.
All right. I think that's it. I think I covered everybody. That's a lot of speakers over 3 days. You guys are definitely going to get your money's worth out of this.
Just to be able to, you know, we're really hopeful about everyone getting inoculated and things getting back somewhat to normalcy.
Yeah.
Just to be able to rekindle some of the spirit of the 2019 first Strange Realities Conference that that was physical in person, and the type of connections you get to make, the type of information that you get to, you know, get from different people, and those hallway conversations. It's just I really can't wait to get back to some of that. And this having, you know, if even half of these people are there in person, it's going to be a really great time. So I encourage, if you can come out, it's going to be a real great time at the physical conference.
Yes.
I think that's it, guys. We want to see you either in Nashville or online. And join us next week, guys. Professor Wham is going to be coming back. And we're going to close out the show. Join us next week on Conspiranormal.
If you would like to help the show, please consider becoming a Patreon at www.patreon.com/conspiranormal or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel.